seconded.
Yeah.
I'm going to call this meeting of the Commerce Committee to order. We do have a quorum. We are not going to take up any minutes today, so we will move right to the bills. The first item on the agenda is House File 3766 from Representative Hansen. I will move House File 3766 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. House File 3766 seeks to expand our caregiver program to allow patients to assign their homegrown plants to a caregiver. With half the nation allowing people to grow cannabis at home for medical and or adult use purposes, including Minnesota, it's important that we do not leave Minnesotans on our medical program out of the opportunity to benefit from homegrown cannabis, especially if they simply need help doing so. To support people with disabilities and their request to allow their caregivers to help them benefit from homegrown cannabis, this bill seeks to increase the number of plants allowed for people on the medical program from 8 to 16 and to allow them to assign their plants to a registered and trusted caregiver to grow on their behalf. We do not think that people with qualifying medical conditions on our medical cannabis program ought to be left out of the ability to benefit from homegrown cannabis simply because they are unable to grow it by themselves. As it stands today, people with disabilities and conditions that qualify them to be on the medical program can only grow their own if they know how to, if they can afford to, if their condition or living situation allows them to, or if they know someone who will gift them homegrown products. As we all know, conditions like those that qualify folks to be on the medical program, like ALS, cancer, chronic or intractable pain, IBS, or other conditions that impact the body and mind, are often chronic and debilitating. But cannabis can significantly improve their quality of life if it is the right medicine for them. Patients on the medical program can obviously purchase products from the medical dispensaries. However, these products are often too expensive and inaccessible to them. Allowing patients to assign their home growing rights to their caregiver will ensure that people with qualifying medical conditions on the medical program can benefit from Minnesota's home growing laws. Patients choose their caregiver, and caregivers already can assist a medical registrant with accessing their cannabis in a variety of ways. But in this bill, the medical registrant could also get help growing their own, and those caregivers generally also have experience growing cannabis in their home. They may already have grow equipment like soil, lighting, and tents, and the experience that these patients would need to help produce the plant that they benefit from so much. You can find our existing medical cannabis caregiver program language in Section 4 of the bill before you, and that already allows patients to designate a caregiver if the patient requires assistance in administering the medical cannabis or obtaining the products or paraphernalia from a dispensary. And this bill simply builds upon our existing and so helpful caregiver structure. And with that, Chair, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you. We do have some people who signed up to testify. I'm going to say this to the whole audience and anyone who's planning to testify at any bill today. We have a lot of bills on the agenda. It's going to be a challenge to get everything in. So please, we're asking everyone to limit your testimony to 2 minutes. When we get to 2 minutes, I'll politely ask you to wrap things up. Our first testifier is Kayla Fearing, who will be followed by Aaron Jensen. Ms. Fearing, if you want to come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Hello again. Hello, Chair Stevenson and the Commerce Committee. Again, my name is Kayla Fearing, and I am a patient advocate, healthcare consultant, and cannabinoid educator. I spent the last year and a half getting feedback from Minnesota patients, home growers, and the cannabis community on the possibility of a caregiver program here in my home state of Minnesota. I've been a medical cannabis patient in the state of Michigan and a patient using their caregiver program since 2021. I have seen the success of a cannabis caregiver program personally in our neighboring state of Michigan. 11 other states currently have and are operating a cannabis caregivers program similar to what the Minnesota community has asked for in HF 3766. Patient and plant counts for caregivers vary state by state. A caregiver program establishes a contract between a contract-based relationship between a patient and a caregiver. A caregiver under HF 3766 can provide individualized cannabis for their patients, products that cannot always be purchased or even found in a medical or recreational dispensary. With Minnesota's strong historical backgrounds in healthcare and agriculture, we've already had the seeds in place to establish an amazing caregivers program. HF3766 would first and foremost create patient accessibility and patient choice within our Minnesota medical cannabis program. Even in other medical programs, dispensary-bought flower has many inconsistencies. Minnesota's current shop choices are reportedly no better for patients. Minnesota patients have reported paying top dollar for existing medical products that contain mold, mildew, or old dried-out cannabis flower, questionable THC potency percentages, again, with one of the most expensive price tags in the country. A caregiver program would provide a local and craft choice for patients to receive their high-quality cannabis flower medicines. HF3766 shortens the gap of entry, becoming an entrepreneur in cannabis as well, allowing caregivers to share their services and producing home-grown cannabis to the medical patient community, provides a path for small businesses for one person, particularly in underrepresented minority communities. As a patient advocate, healthcare consultant, and cannabis educator, I ask this committee to see the benefits that a cannabis caregiver program would bring Minnesota patients and our craft cannabis farmers and home growers. Please allow patients and these craft home growers to flourish under new home grow cannabis laws and not define these stewards of the plant as criminals by definition. Minnesota patients should not be forced to depend on gifting of our medicines if we cannot successfully produce cannabis crops for ourselves with home grow and not be forced back to an out-of-state medical cannabis gifting or out-of-state medical companies or gifting.
I'll need you to conclude your testimony, please.
Awesome. Thank you for hearing HF 3766 in this committee. Myself and the cannabis caregiver community are open for negotiations, and I am available for questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Aaron Jensen, who will be followed by Adam Wagner. Ms. Jensen, please come forward. State your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Chair Stevenson, Adam could not make it today.
Oh, do we have Aaron?
This is Aaron. Eric.
Eric.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's Mr. Jensen, state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Good afternoon, Minnesota lawmakers. My name is Eric Jensen. I'm a veteran and resident of Rochester, Minnesota. Today, I'm here to speak on the importance of a medical caregiver program in Minnesota. I was a medical caregiver in Michigan for 3 years. Growing medical cannabis is difficult. It's an expensive hobby to set up, requires a lot of attention to detail and time. Allowing caregivers to grow for only one patient gives patients less access to their desired medication. Michigan medical patients have access.
Sir, can you just pull the mic closer to you, please?
Of course.
Thank you. I apologize for interrupting you.
Michigan medical patients have access to the best medicine because their lawmakers set regulations that would allow for it. Michigan caregiver program allows for state licensed caregivers to grow up to 72 plants. While this may seem excessive, let me try to clear some things up. There are three main stages of cannabis cultivation: cloning, seedlings, mother plants, which is your genetic library, vegetative growth, and flowering plants. Only allowing for 8 plants makes it impossible for caregivers to search for new types of genetic traits and cannabinoids that will help medical patients. I've had patients with severe debilitating genetic diseases, such as muscular dystrophy and Crohn's disease. I have also helped patients with work-related injuries that have left them severely disabled for the rest of their lives. Because of these unique diseases and their symptoms, sometimes patients need 2 to 3 different types of cannabis medicine just to get through their day normally, like me and you. An example of this might be a patient with a muscular dystrophy needing pain relief and more appetite during the day to help keep their strength up, and might need a different type of symptom relief in the evening or at night. Most people don't know, but many founding fathers grew acres of hemp with various levels of cannabinoids for many uses. America and Americans succeed when they have the freedom of religion, freedom of where they work, freedom of who they love, and freedom to source their own foods and medicine. Setting low plant count stifles the level of care patients can receive from their caregivers. Thank you for your time and the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move. Sir, you can come on down and testify now.
Chair well, Stevenson, members of the committee, I'm Mark Hughes. Thanks for this opportunity today. I have followed a little bit of this history of the bill, believe it or not. Under the Governor Dayton administration, it was said to be started out with the State Highway Patrol and let them kind of decide as to how we should handle it, and then kind of put out to the general register, as I remember it. And now we are at still a medical care and a social responsibility. The medical care, I'm all for and I support it. The social responsibility, I've got an open mind and I support this bill that we're all adults and we'll know how to handle it. The only question I've had on it is when we're driving, your response time on the accelerant and the brake reaction tends to be a little slower and may cause an accident. So all I'm saying is if you're going to use it as a recreational, be careful, use it wisely. Medical, I'm for it all the way, so I support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony today. We'll move now to member discussion and questions to the bill. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'd like to understand a little bit better how this would interact with the House File 100 legislation that was passed last session. That already allows for cannabis growing in homes. My recollection, you certainly know the bill far better than I do, but my recollection is that there are strict testing requirements for cultivators to ensure safety, accuracy, and labeling, whatever it may be. How does this interact with that?
You want to answer that, Representative sure. Hansen?
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, and thank you, Representative Brindley. Sorry I missed the beginning of your question, but I think I grasped the gist of it regarding testing. Current homegrown cannabis does not require testing right now, and there's actually very, very, very few options for people who are growing cannabis at home in order for it to be tested. And so it's my opinion that setting a different or a higher bar for people with disabilities who simply need help growing their own cannabis at home is not inclusive. And so if the expectation is that all homegrown cannabis must be tested before consumption, then we need to also acknowledge that the testing infrastructure in Minnesota and nationwide, honestly, does not exist yet. I really support expanding testing options to homegrown cannabis once our infrastructure can support it, but I suspect that the vast majority of caregivers and home cultivators worth their salt would definitely utilize this service once it's available, whether it's required or not, actually. And so for now, pushing for testing on homegrown cannabis only for this group of patients who use a home grower is not as equitable, especially when those services don't even exist yet. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A little bit, I guess, to put a finer point on it, I'm just wondering, like, why would this be necessary with House File 100? Because House File 100 already significantly expanded home growing, home cultivation. So why is this necessary in addition to that?
So I'll turn over to Representative Hansen, but House File 100 allowed any Minnesotan adult to grow up to 8 plants at home, four of which can be mature. This bill allows people who are in the medical program to have more plants and to assign their plants to their caregiver. So if you are current, there's no way to assign your plants to someone else under the current law. So this bill would allow someone who lives in an apartment building or some other, or just is not able to grow on their own to assign those plants to another person to grow. And Representative Hansen, I don't know if you have anything you want to add to that. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. No, I appreciate it. And I think the conversation is worth having because I don't know that we all necessarily realized who we were leaving out of our home grow program because growing cannabis at home requires such strict routines and patterns and upkeep, and it's a very delicate process. And also the cost of lighting and other materials can be quite expensive. And especially for people with disability, I mean, I'm preaching to the choir on this, and I recognize that Representative New Brindley, that, you know, we know that people with disabilities have lower incomes and that it is harder for them to access a lot of things. And folks with disabilities need a hand just navigating the world as it is. And this is the hand that they're looking for in order to navigate our current home grow program.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last comment. And I guess I would consider, you know, I mean, we talked about things. I heard from the testifiers comments about quality and the craft industry and things like this. I would just question whether or not, given our new structure, given that certainly medical growers have stringent requirements placed on them right now, and under the new laws, there's strict requirements for cultivator operations. I would question whether or not trying these new things and this craft industry, I would question whether or not caregivers are the best place to do that. They're not trained in this. This isn't, and we're treating this as medicine in this situation particularly. And so I would question whether or not this is the most appropriate way to move forward on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tisa-Bouton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hansen, you've been a tremendous advocate for folks with disabilities across many spectrums, and I think that, you know, this bill is no different. Just out of curiosity, and so that I'm understanding the intention of the bill, the caregiver who, you know, presumably is coming to a person's home, the plants, they can be kept at the caregiver's home location and not at the patient's home location. So they're not coming to the home to care for the plants in addition to caring for the person. They can cultivate them at a different location.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. Thank you, Vice Chair Katsizo-Watun. Right now, the current bill before us allows the patient who would normally have their plants in their home that they're legally allowed to grow to simply assign them to a registered and trusted caregiver of their choosing. And we do propose increasing their allowed plants from 8 to 16, though as my testifier said, we stand ready to negotiate on that. Of course, we wanted to bring the conversation before you. I would imagine that if a patient does have the space in their home to grow cannabis, that their caregiver, you know, who's picking up medicine from the dispensary from them, who's helping them, may also help them garden a little bit too. So that is already an option for them. But unfortunately, for folks who are living in situations where they cannot grow in their facility, whether it's because they have roommates or other qualifications or landlord restrictions, lease restrictions, or simply their ability level, that then they could have their plants just picked up, moved to their caregiver's house, and taken care of at a satellite location.
Representative Katsizo-Watun.
Thank you. Thanks for that. That helps me visualize how this could work a little bit more easily. And then finally, just kind of going through the language, I don't see at this point any discussion on like fee for service. So, I mean, it's looking like it doesn't exclude that a caregiver in an existing relationship that, you know, they may be being compensated for caregiving, but then that this could be potentially added on above and beyond that. Are there any concerns about that, like from, you know, people then being charged with an existing relationship that already is monetized in some way, potentially through insurance or along those levels, like that then they would be charging for this service that they're providing as a part of their caregiving relationship?
Mm-hmm. Representative Hans.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Vice Chair Katsizo-Watun. We do have that existing registration that requires the caregivers, and that's managed within OMC right now. And those caregivers right now, and I think it's important for the public to know this, that these caregivers are doing so for no compensation. They're doing so because it's the right thing to do to help the people who need the hand. And caregivers in all sectors, not just in the context of this bill, but they're in the business, if you will, or the community of helping people who have disabilities. And so our current caregiver program allows them to, like I said, assign a caregiver to pick up their meds from the dispensary, travel with their patient's products, and help administer if necessary, and obtain paraphernalia from a medical dispensary. And so this would expand the opportunity for the caregivers with those plant limits. But really, I fully support expanding a world where we recognize the value that caregivers give to people with disabilities in the medical cannabis program and statewide. We drastically underpay folks who provide these critical services, and we're doing better. This legislature in the last session has done amazing at increasing the pay and on workplace protections and a lot of things. And so this is an area where I would love the support to continue to grow at a model where caregivers can have a clear and defined compensation model that we can all discuss, debate, and agree upon. But that is not part of the bill today. We're building upon the existing caregiver program as it is today, where these caregivers are providing these services at no compensation.
Representative Dotson.
Thank you, Chairman. Representative, question I've got is the caregiver themselves, do they have to actually live at the location that the plants are grown, the 16 plants are grown, as well as is there a limit of how many clients that the caregiver can help facilitate for? So could, if they've got contracts for, say, 16 clients, could they then grow for 16 clients that they're helping out?
President Hanson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the question, Representative. There, right now, we're open to negotiation on that. I just want to start what I'm saying with that piece of it, that if people have a lot of heartburn about where the bill stands today, please contact me. I'm open to negotiating. As far as where those plants are, the caregiver grows them. It is generally in their home, the caregiver's home, assuming that the patient's home does not allow for it. Now, if, again, like I mentioned to our vice chair, if that patient does have space in their home, then the caregiver could already be helping to take care of those plants in the patient's home. But the caregiver model here allows those plants to be moved from the patient's home to the caregiver's home as like a proxy location for them to grow at. And as far as the numbers go, again, open to negotiation. Right now, we have it set that a caregiver can care for up to 6 patients in our current language right now, but we can, like I said, certainly change that on this one if there's a concern about somebody having 6 times 16 plants. I see the concern there.
Thank you.
Closing comments, Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members, for the vibrant discussion. I really appreciate you opening your minds to consider what this could look like. We're doing a really great job at improving how we support people with disabilities in Minnesota, and this is just another step in the right direction, and I appreciate your support.
All right. Thank you for bringing the bill, and the bill is laid over. The next item on the agenda is House File 3760, also from Representative Hanson. I will move House File 3760 before the committee. Representative Hanson, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair, and again, committee members. I will be very brief to respect your time as much as possible. House File 3760 is a patient protection bill to ensure that people with qualifying medical conditions on the medical cannabis program have some additional protections from being retaliated against for their choice of medicine for their condition. This bill adds a layer of protection for licensed professionals, students, and renters to ensure fewer registered medical patients lose their jobs, their educational opportunities, or their housing as a result of prohibition-era stigma that deters even medical cannabis use today. Licensed professionals have reported that licensing boards are taking actions on their licenses by requiring some medical patients undergo substance use disorder treatment to keep their license after discovering that the licensee is on the registered medical cannabis program. We've heard from parents of children who rely on medical cannabis have reported that schools have refused to enroll their child or that the school penalized a child based on the medicine that they use to improve their quality of life. We've heard from people on the medical program who have been harassed, fined, and even evicted by landlords for consuming their medicine in their homes. People have shared with me that they are afraid to even pursue the option of medical cannabis for their condition or show support for this bill or sign up to testify today for fear of retaliation by their employer, their school, their landlord, or their board. Qualifying medical conditions are chronic and can be debilitating, as we've already discussed. And people with these conditions are not simply using cannabis for recreational or fun purposes. Just as diabetics use insulin to treat a condition that they have no control over, medical cannabis patients do the same. Ultimately, cannabis is a healing plant for millions of people globally, and people with qualifying medical conditions in Minnesota deserve the opportunity to use the medicine that they have been prescribed by their doctor without fear of losing their livelihood, their access to education, or their homes. And I will turn it over to my testifier.
Wonderful. And we have Maren Schroeder. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. This will probably be my shortest testimony ever. My name is Maren Schroeder. I am the Policy Director for Sensible Change Minnesota, a patient and consumer-led advocacy nonprofit. I've worked with medical cannabis patients since the implementation of Minnesota's medical cannabis program in 2015. And whenever another community leader runs into a patient-related problem, they oftentimes send them to me. That's resulted in probably hundreds of Facebook messages, emails, phone calls, text messages about issues with this program, and that's why I'm here all the time talking to you guys. But a lot of those revolve around things that fall within this patient protection area. As Representative Hanson relayed, many patients have seen issues with landlords, schools, employers, licensing boards, and other agents with power. Due to the nature of chronic illness, most of the time there is a power imbalance, and patients are unable to assert their rights already found in statute. This is the fifth year Sensible Change has brought this legislation or similar legislation forward, And while small pieces of it have made it into law, we're hopeful that we can build upon previous year's work and get more of these provisions across the finish line this year. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Member discussion and questions to the bill. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen. I'm wondering how this would work with somebody who maybe has a CDL license and is a professional driver, or heavy equipment operator, or something along those lines. I think those would fall under professions that have that professional licensing. How would this interact with those?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson, and thank you, Representative Brindley. The protections for employers in safety-sensitive positions remain. We understand that people under the influence of cannabis in different positions in the workforce have different impacts. What this bill really seeks to address is making sure that the people who are not impacted, people who are simply using cannabis, especially out of their job, like on the weekends, even outside of work, are finding themselves subject to retaliation for simply being on the program. And so we want to make sure we can amplify those needs, but also recognize that having a need for safety is still the highest priority, and this does not affect that.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. I would just say, I mean, that's part of the problem we have, though, with this particularly, right, is that there's still there. We don't have an effective testing mechanism. Somebody can use this product on Saturday, and there's no way to distinguish on Monday, which is part of the problem we have. And I think because of that, this wades into territory that is a little dangerous that we probably don't want to do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Brindley. I just would like to share your point about the safety concerns. That's not what we're attempting to do here. But students don't have CDLs. Renters are not subject to CDL things. And so this also addresses the issues with students and renters and folks with licensing boards. We've seen nurses, teachers, social workers, therapists, licensed marriage family therapists, physical therapists, and a number of other folks who don't fall into the group of employers that we generally think of when we're talking about that, like you've mentioned with the CDLs. And so this is seeking to make sure that a board cannot just take action solely on the person being on the medical program, whether or not they're under the influence during their job, and if that violates their employer, you know, requirements is a different story. But solely being on the medical program should not subject somebody to license action.
Representative Brindley, one. Okay, you're good. Representative O'Driscoll.
I'll pass. Just in the interest of time.
Okay. Closing comments, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committees. I appreciate you hearing this bill. I'll give you your time back. Thank you.
All right. Thank you much. That bill is laid over. The next item on our agenda today is House File 4789 from Chair Herr. I will move House File 4789 before the committee. Chair Herr, when you're settled, you can describe your bill.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and committee. Before you is House File 4789. It's a bill to permit physicians to prescribe cannabis. So I think you are all probably the most familiar with this, but when cannabis, the medical cannabis program was first established, there were some constraints around what would qualify as a condition that someone can get prescribed cannabis. And so we know that, and there was two ways in which, you know, we put some of these things in laws, but the other way is that the Department of Health could also make exceptions and add additional conditions onto that list. And that is a very small list, and it is very prohibitive, and that there are other conditions which could benefit from having this expanded, but they cannot at this point. And we would like to just expand this so that it is no longer just the Department of health that actually makes the exception, but that between a physician and a patient, and considering the condition, that physician can prescribe medical cannabis. So the bill is pretty simple, and that is what is in front of you.
Thank you, Chair Herr. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, discussion to the bill. Representative New Brindley.
Who knew I was so interested in cannabis?
I know. It's not Cannabis Day. It's Representative Brindley Day. Representative Brindley.
However, it's interesting. I do my best. It's interesting as I read this. You know, shortly after this medical cannabis legislation was passed, I had patient providers, specifically GI docs, come to me and say, "Ann, why in the world is this on that list? I'm never going to prescribe this." And I did some digging, and as it turns out, literally one patient with Crohn's disease came and testified, and it's in law. Like, this is how the sausage is made, people. It's pretty wild. And same idea for ALS, right? I went to a research symposium and talked to physicians, and they're like, yeah, we would never prescribe marijuana for ALS. Like, and that's obviously something I'm much more familiar with. So frankly, as I look at this and I look at this moving the decision making from the commissioner to a healthcare practitioner, probably should have been this way from the beginning. So well done.
100% agree. Any closing comments, Representative?
No, just that this is reasonable and a good bill, as Representative New said, and so I appreciate the support for it.
All right, and I'll just note, I know you've been working with agencies on this language, and you're working on an amendment that we didn't have time for today, but may come back in a future hearing. So thank you for your work with the agency. I appreciate it. With that, the bill's laid open. The next item on the agenda today is House File 4251, also from Chair Herr. I will move House File 4251 be laid over for possible inclusion, and Chair Herr, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and committee, for hearing another cannabis
This one we're not moving to layover. We are moving this bill to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. That's the motion. Chair Herr.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and committee. I appreciate the opportunity to share this bill with all of you. I'm going to try to be brief here as well. House File 4251, which prohibits the sale of flavored cannabis products that are burned, inhaled, or vaporized. This bill does not address low-potency edibles or beverages that are already legally sold on the market. We know from commercial tobacco policy work that kid-friendly flavors are used to make commercial tobacco products taste better, look less harmful, and are more appealing. And we know from other states and here in Minnesota that the cannabis industry is pulling from the same playbook. We've already seen schools struggling with flavored cannabis vapes in addition to flavored nicotine vapes that are being sold illegally. Let's make sure that when the sale of recreational cannabis goes into effect, those flavored products aren't on our shelves. I do have a few examples of these products that were confiscated from local high schools. These are taken from our kiddos. We can pass this around so that all of you get a chance to see it as well. But, you know, they look so similar to flavored nicotine vapes. And so it's very clear to us that, you know, the same things that have been happening that led to our kids being hooked on a generation of tobaccos is the same playbook using for cannabis as well. And so I ask that the committee support this work. And in closing, I did want to say that there was similar language that was included in House File 100 last year, and it was removed in the second conference report. And I think that it's important for us to right this wrong and add in this guardrail to make cannabis that is burned or inhaled, that we take care of that in this legislature. So thank you.
Thank you. We do have a couple people who signed up to testify. We'll start with Emily Myatt. We'll be followed by Curtis Neff. Ms. Myatt, state your name for the record. Proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and committee members. My name's Emily Myatt. I am the Government Relations Director for the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network, and I'm also one of the chairs of Minnesotans for a Smoke-Free Generation, which is a coalition of more than 50 organizations across the state from all different perspectives of public health, health plans, patient advocacy groups, individual community-based organizations. And we come together for this common goal of advancing justice by striving towards a future where every person is free from the harms of commercial tobacco and can reach their full health potential. And it's with that lens that our coalition stands in support of the bill before you today because of our work around flavored commercial tobacco product. As Representative Herr said, and you're going to hear on the next bill, the tobacco industry's marketing of menthol and other candy and fruit flavored products has propelled use among young people, Black Minnesotans, American Indians, and LGBTQIA community members. From our perspective, this bill is about public health and health equity. We're sending a message as a state that bad actors in the cannabis industry can't sell flavored cannabis products that are burned or inhaled. And I'd add the bill does not penalize individuals for purchase, use, or possession of flavored cannabis, rather shifts that responsibility onto retailers and the Office of Cannabis Management. Thank you.
Next, we have Curtis Neff.
Good afternoon. My name is Curtis Knapp. I'm a community organizer with the Association of Non-Smokers. I'm here to support House File 4251. The cannabis industry is already replicating tactics of the tobacco industry by using flavors to make products taste better and be more appealing, which is to the detriment to the public health and our kids. Despite cannabis sales not being legal yet in our state, flavored cannabis vapes are overtaking our communities and our schools. I've spoken to many school administrators and licensed alcohol and drug counselors. They all tell me the same thing. It's nearly impossible to tell flavored cannabis and flavored nicotine vapes apart, and it's the flavors that are driving students to use an addiction. Our schools are already stretched thin and challenged to meet the needs of students. They need your help. Getting rid of all the flavored cannabis that is burned, inhaled, vaped will be a lifeline for them. As a longtime union organizer, one of my core beliefs is that industry must not be allowed to operate unchecked. Regulations like the one in this bill before you are not a burden for industry. They are protections for people. Cannabis policy should be established with an eye towards health equity for children, young people, low-income communities, Black, Indigenous, and people of color. This bill will do just that. This policy is too important to delay, and it should have been done last year, but there's still time to get it right. So please pass House File 4251. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? See a couple hands, so you can come down, sit down. Sir, if you want to come down so you're ready next, you can just state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee, and remember, 2 minutes.
My name is Jeff Taylor, and what I want to say about this, I opened up a vape shop probably 15 years ago, and the reason I opened up a vape shop is I wanted to get my parents and other people to stop smoking. But the thing that I want you guys to do for 1 second is just take yourself back to high school, because we keep talking about children. I have 3 daughters, okay, so I care about children highly. But if you take yourself back to high school for just 1 second and think about what you did in high school and what other people did, and if the worst thing that you ever did was smoke a nicotine vape, your parents should pat themselves on the back. Because there's a whole lot of other things. I mean, we can go to the extreme, and we can ban cherry vodka. I mean, we can ban a lot of flavors. Matter of fact, we should probably go ban chocolate malts at Dairy Queen, because vanilla is better for you. It's not going to stop people. This is a parenting thing, okay? And so I don't think it's something that we need to just stop and people from selling it. The reality is they're just going to go to the internet and do it. It's a parenting thing.
Thank you for your testimony. Sir, if you want to come down, same thing, if you state your name for the record and proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
My name is Robert Stephen Cornell. I'm the owner of Cornell Urban Agriculture. I'm a legacy hemp grower and processor here. I'd just like to say I also have a 15-year-old son who talks to me, you know, in depth about this quite a bit. I will say that I believe that the flavors are not actually the problem unless they're marketed as an enhancement towards that. The problem where it hinders the industry is that cannabis has natural terpenes, so there are flavors in there regardless. In order to get rid of those, you'd actually have to do chemical extractions, and part of those include dangerous chemicals. So you would have to actually increase the complication of the processing, where I believe that if it's simply limited to, you know, the marketing intention of it, just like the cartoon characters, maybe they're not, you know, strawberry or other flavors, but they might need to have a name to identify themselves as a differentiation in the market. And that could also be affected by the unique characteristics of the cannabis genetics themselves, and part of those include the terpenes and the flavonoids, and those have been reported to affect, the consumption reaction, pretty dramatically, and that doesn't appear on tests. So I think you could avoid that just without marketing towards, something that's going to attract children. But excluding the flavors themselves would dramatically hinder the industry.
Thank you for your testimony. Member discussion and questions to the bill. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hurd, do other states have this cannabis flavor ban? I'm kind of curious.
Chair Hurd.
Chair Stevenson, Representative Cagle. From what I understand, yes, some states do, but I do have a testifier who could probably be more specific on this.
Ms. Maya.
Representative Cagle. My understanding is that no other states have regulated flavored cannabis that's burned or inhaled. Several states have introduced legislation and are trying to work through the process.
Representative Cagle.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And does the Minnesota Medical Program allow for flavors?
This?
Ms. Myatt.
Sorry. Chair Stevenson, Representative Cagle, current status is any products are allowed to be flavored right now. That's why our bill is coming in and just taking those additives out. I would say that the bill does not address or cover the natural flavors that come in cannabis, only those additive flavors like fruit, candy flavors, but none of the natural flavors the previous testifier was talking about. Thank you.
Representative Freeborn.
Thank you very much, Chair Stevenson. I would just like to thank you, Chair Hur, for bringing this bill forward. For somebody who has struggled to breathe for many, many years, I think it's really important that anything that we can do to protect lungs, and we're seeing in young people the damage to their lungs so much earlier. So whether they're students in high school or young adults in college, I think this is a product that we want to make sure is limited in scope. Thank you.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a couple of questions, or one that just came up during the conversation, but can you just run through again? I think I may have misheard, but at the beginning, in your opening comments, I thought you said that this does not apply to some of the low potency stuff, hemp-derived stuff that's already on the market.
Chair.
Oh, I was just going to say, but as I read it in line 2.16, and so maybe I'm missing something, the office must not approve cannabis flower, cannabis product, or hemp-derived, 2.13, if the product is an edible cannabis product or lower potency hemp edible. So I guess that's what's in existing law. How does this, that stuff is still exempt?
Chair Hur?
Chair Stevenson, Representative Brindley, I'm going to have Ms. Myatt. We're looking at that language right now, too, as well.
Ms. Myatt?
Representative New Brindley, that's correct. The low potency is exempt from this flavors legislation before you. It only applies to flavored cannabis that's burned, inhaled, or vaporized.
I'm going to ask Mr. Johnson to provide some clarity on this as well. Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Representative New Brindley, that answer is correct. The provision that you're looking at, Representative New Brindley, would apply to the lower potency hemp edibles. This new section is a new paragraph that starts at page 2, line 16, and so the flavor ban only applies to those products that are inhaled as smoke, aerosol, or vapor, so that would not include the current lower potency edibles.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you. And then my next question is, that was an interesting question about how this might apply to medical. And so my question is, how does the new law interact with this on a medical stamp, from a medical perspective? And can these things, can smoke, aerosol, or vapor have a medical value to minors under the new law?
Chair Hur.
Representative Stevenson, and this bill does, it would apply to medical cannabis as well. And I think that, you know, and funny thing is, I didn't say this in the other bill that was presented, but the reason why medical cannabis works for children is because we take out all of the smells and all of the taste and all of the effects of it, and just has the pure potency of the medical use of the cannabis. And so we actually are, you know, that's best practice now in medical cannabis. And so this applies to that as well.
I'll give you one more follow-up if you want it.
Sure. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Oh, you didn't even want it? All right, take it back. Take it back.
I would just say that's an interesting point, that this does apply to the medical cannabis program, because I think we know that, you know, I mean, for example, folks undergoing chemotherapy, like, I mean, a big problem is just appetite suppression and not wanting anything. And so this actually, taking this way, could actually have a negative effect there, that having those flavors could actually be helpful in those situations with that legitimate medical use. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Closing comments, Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Stevenson. And I know I'm going to take a little bit more time on this one in closing, just because this is really important to me. I carried the bill last year for the Juul and Altria settlement. It was the largest settlement per capita that our state saw, and so versus the other states. And that it was because it was proven that these e-cigarettes were using deceptive practices, and that is why we won that lawsuit. And I think it's important for us to remember that we know that it is already happening, and that if we don't get ahead of this now, it will continue to happen. And I know I've heard a lot of arguments as to why we shouldn't be regulating products that adults can use and products that are legal. But the truth is that government regulates products that are harmful for people all the time. And when things taste this way, and I'm not a smoker, and the worst thing I did in high school, like, was not this. It was probably, like, not doing dishes after school or something, right? And so I was a pretty straight-laced kid. But I did try my first flavored cigar, like, a couple years ago, and it was chocolate. And I tasted that thing, and I was like, wow, this is delicious. I could smoke cigars. I could hang out with Representative Nash all day long smoking cigars. Right? And I realized that as an adult, I understood that it was the chocolate that was appealing to me. But as a child who's not understanding that when they're taking a puff out of these contraptions, that they don't realize they're taking in huge amounts of nicotine, and they're smoking more than they would if they were actually smoking an actual blunt or taking a gummy, that they're actually doing more of that. And so I think that it is really important for us to protect our youth. And, you know, I really thought about what other products does government regulate that is people can buy, right? And we decided that lead-based paint was not good for children and brain development. Government regulated paints and saying that even though lead makes paint more pretty, it's more illustrious, it lasts longer, it protects whatever you're painting better, we said it's harmful to people, and so we regulate that. And we said you can still sell paint, you just can't sell lead-based paint. This is the same thing. We can still sell cannabis. You can still use it. You can still buy it. You just can't do it in a form that is harmful to people who might not understand the harm in it. And so I do ask that this committee really support this bill and that we are able to get it out of here and you know, put it into effect. So and before it actually becomes law, and then we have to try to take something back. Someone said to me, you can't put toothpaste back into the bottle, right? So once it's already available, it is much harder for us to roll it back. So I would appreciate the committee support in this.
All right. I will renew my motion that House File 4251 be recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and House File 4251 is recommended to be referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. The next item on our agenda today is House File 2177 from our own Representative Cha. And when you are settled, please make your motion.
Mr. Chair.
You want to move your bill, Representative O'Driscoll?
The purpose of passing those around is not to take them, just to view them. Is that the idea?
Yes.
I just want clarification.
Yes.
All right. Representative Chow, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, I'd like to move 2177, possible for inclusion for the Commerce Bill.
Great. And then you have the A24 amendment?
Yes, I would also like to move that amendment.
All right. And there's an oral amendment that I will just quickly move. It's to delete line 1.11 from the A24. And Mr. Johnson, could you just state that amendment, oral amendment?
Representative Stevenson moves to amend the A24-0205 amendment as follows. Page 1, delete line 11.
Any discussion to the oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Oral amendment prevails. Underlying amendment. This gets the bill in the shape you'd like the committee to consider it. Is that correct, Representative Cha?
Yes.
All right. Any discussion to the underlying amendment, A24-0205? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. A24-0205 is adopted as amended. Representative Cha, it's your bill as amended.
Thank you, Chair Stephen. I'd like to present to you House File 2177. This bill is to aim to address the critical issue, the prevalence of flavored tobacco products targeting our youth and BIPOC communities here in Minnesota. Tobacco smoking is the number one cause of lung cancer, not only in Minnesota, but in the United States of America. The death tolls for cancer surpasses the total for HIV, illegal drug use, alcohol, motor vehicles, and firearm deaths in the United States of America. 6,500 Minnesotans die from the use of smoking, attributed deaths every year. $4.7 billion in health care costs to the state of Minnesota, and another $4 billion to productivity in the state of Minnesota. 14% of eighth graders are using e-cigarettes, and 7% of eighth graders are also vaping. Of the African community, 88% are using menthol tobacco products. 29 of the Minnesota communities have already enacted and implemented a flavor ban in their cities and in the counties. And I think that we should follow suit. As a father and a father of three daughters, I have personal experience from having my daughter taken on this product. I won't read her full testimony, but I'll read quotes that she wrote to me. "Dad, I prioritized my vaping before my food rations. I always felt depressed, alone, scared. And I felt naked when I didn't vape. My days cannot start without vaping. I felt my life was on pause. I tried to quit, but it was too late. I was addicted to nicotine. Access was not an issue. There was always a willing adult buying this product for me." And with that, I would like to turn over to the testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Shaw. We do have a number of testifiers today on this bill, and I'm going to remind everyone that we're going to limit everyone to 2 minutes. Representative Shaw, if you wouldn't mind sitting at the table here, because I'm going to call down two people at a time so that we can go very quickly. So first we have Bukata Hayes, who will be followed by Damone Presley. Mr. Hayes, state your name for the record. Proceed your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Yeah. Bukata Hayes. Good morning, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. My name is Bukata Hayes. I'm the Vice President of Racial and Health Equity and Chief Equity Officer at Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. I'm here testifying today on behalf of Minnesotans for a Smoke-Free Generation. The coalition stands in strong support of House File 2177 because of the key role it will play in disrupting the cycle of generations of youth becoming addicted to commercial tobacco. The health impacts of commercial tobacco are well established, and the tobacco industry's marketing of menthol and other flavored products has propelled use among youth, communities of color, and the LGBTQIA plus community. In 2020, the House Select Committee on Racial Justice recommended that Minnesota end the sale of all menthol and flavored tobacco products in order to address the systemic disparities and inequities commercial tobacco has caused. At Blue Cross, we did a study, recently commissioned a study to understand the cost of smoking to our state. Minnesota spends about $4.7 billion a year on health care costs directly caused by smoking. Yep, that's billions. And that breaks down to about $824 for every adult and child. In addition to that, and indirect health costs, smoking costs us $4.7 billion a year in lost productivity. That makes a combined $9.4 billion. And all those costs are burdens to taxpayers, employers, and the healthcare system. It's deeply personal to me. Many family members have smoked, have lost uncles and other family members to smoking, but the one I'll raise today is my grandmother. My grandmother, Hazel Hayes, started smoking at 13, addicted to commercial tobacco, smoked for about 30 years, died of cancer at 43. I was about a year old when that happened. She did not get to sort of foster these long-lasting memories with her grandchildren. She smoked Cool 100s, and so everybody knows that that's a menthol-flavored product. So smoking cost my family, cost my mom, her mother. My grandmother passed at the age of 43. My mom was 24. My uncle, Billy, was 25. They had to raise two younger brothers, 14 and 15. So smoking and the impact of menthol, in particular within my family in the inner city of Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is heavy. And so I would say we can't wait another year. Every year we do nothing.
Conclude your testimony.
Yep. Thank you. The real consequence of the escalating health and economic burden on Minnesota's disproportionately impacting communities of color is well established. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony and sharing your story. Next we have Damone Presley, who will be followed by Anna Grace Teed-Hottinger. So if you want to come down and have a seat there, Mr. Presley, you can proceed your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Stevenson and community members. My name is Damone Presley. Over 16 years, I've been free from drugs and alcohol. My calling in life is to help others live a life free of addiction. This has brought me to the Twin Cities Recovery Project. I'm a certified peer recovery specialist, and I lead the commercial tobacco, nicotine, and youth sensation program. I'm here to share perspectives from the local policy level. 29 Minnesota communities have passed this policy, and in your packets, you'll receive letters from support from law enforcement, local electives who support and pass this policy, including border communities. St. Paul and Minneapolis passed restrictions to limit flavored tobacco sales to adult-only tobacco stores. In your package, you'll see a letter from local electors from both cities saying if they would do it again, they would have completely ended to sell flavored products because it would have had a more significant public health impact. I've been in the battle with the tobacco industry for decades. From my experience, I know if you give them an inch, they'll take a mile. If you grant the industry access to a community, they'll exploit them. They will also work hard to convince decision makers that industry-driven solutions are best for the community. You may hear fear-mongering about products being made in basements or sold from car trunks. I work with cities in implementation and compliance checks, and I can say it's going well. But in a few instances, it's not. It's the retailers who are actually the true problem, not following the law. Another fear-based message you may have heard from the tobacco industry is ending the sale of menthol tobacco would actually hurt the African-American community by increasing police harassment. To be clear, this bill does nothing to criminalize individuals addicted to these products.
Well, I'll need you to conclude your testimony now.
All right. This bill was focused on the industry, holding them accountable, and their marketing targeted to targeted communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Next is Anna Grace Teed Hottinger, who will be followed by Nick Phelps. Please state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Anna Grace Teed Hottinger. 4 years ago, the last time that this bill was heard in this committee, I was a junior in high school and talking about it then. Some of you heard me say it then and will hear me say it again, that the tobacco industry is a big tobacco industry. Tobacco use is a huge issue in high schools and elementary schools. But now, because of its inaction, it's huge in middle schools, elementary schools, and in colleges all over the board. The industry manufactures products that look harmless and spends millions marketing here in Minnesota. You may not see these ads for these products, but it's because you guys are not the target audience. Just because you can't see it doesn't mean that it's not happening. Marketing is a commerce issue. The tobacco industry uses chemical flavors, fun ads, and good designs, and hosts incredible parties to put their products in front of young people. Last summer, Loon, which is a Minnesota company, hosted a yacht party. It was a four-hour vape and booze cruise. IDs were never checked. But there was an open bar and free nicotine products that were being given out. There are all kinds of flavors like kiwi, emoji, and so on. And now Philip Morris, the maker of Marlboro, is making Zyn products, which are Zyn nicotine pouches, which is the latest trend. This morning, actually, I was sitting in bed, I came up on four or five different TikToks around Zyn. I'm a part of the lost generation. Like I said, when I was here last time, I was in high school. However, now I'm 21, and 18 to 24-year-olds use e-cigarettes more than any other adult group, and we are more likely to be dual users using e-cigarettes and smoking cigarettes. A lot of my friends who started vaping are now cigarette users. How many years do we need to have this conversation and me to keep coming back? I'd rather be unemployed than not talking about this issue. Please don't make me keep coming back and speaking about it. We have science from other states and real life examples of how industry marketing leads to completely preventable addiction, disease, and death.
Your testimony.
Yes, absolutely. We cannot wait another year. Every year we do nothing, another 10,000 Minnesotans kids try cigarettes for the first time, thanks to $97 billion big tobacco spends every year marketing in Minnesota. And one last tidbit, I know a lot of you are
really
environmental folks.
Conclude.
Yeah, you're good.
Sorry.
There's a really good letter on the disposal of vapes and how much
Thank
they
you.
Cost. Thank
All right.
You.
Next is Nick Phelps, who will be followed by Kimmy Porter.
Mr. Hello. Phelps. Hi. My name is Nick Phelps. I and my parents are the owners of Ohm Premier Vaping in Ramsey, Minnesota. We are not big tobacco. I want to make that very clear that we are not in any way, shape, or form affiliated with or are big tobacco. We are a small, family-owned store, and we sell adult products in an adult-only store. This certificate right here reads, Responsible Tobacco Retailer. And we show these in our store with pride. It was given to our shop by the Ramsey Police Department when they sent an underage person into our store to try to purchase vapor products. That person was carded, found to be underage, denied product, and was asked to leave our store. The same scenario plays out frequently in our business, the same way it does at liquor stores when an underage person tries to purchase alcoholic beverages. The difference is liquor store owners are not told that they are responsible for it because they are selling flavored vodkas or fruity drink mixes, which tempt underage youth. Instead, the underage person who is charged with the minor consumption or the person who is buying it for them is charged with contributing to the delinquency of a minor. There is no difference between these two scenarios. But the state holds the vapor industry to a different standard than the liquor industry is held to. Anyone underage who enters our store to try and purchase vapor products is breaking the law. They are not innocent, nor they are being force-fed nicotine products by an evil industry trying to hook them on nicotine. They are coming into our store knowing that they are intending to illegally purchase a product that they know they are not old enough to use. And they know that these products contain nicotine. They also know that nicotine is an addictive chemical the same way they know that alcohol can be addictive.
And I'll need you to conclude your testimony.
Okay. We have more than 4,000 adult customers in our database, and we have helped thousands of adults switch from smoking deadly cigarettes to a far less dangerous product. Most of them quit vaping as well and eventually walk away from the addiction altogether.
And I really do need you to conclude your testimony.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I'm having to cut off a lot of people this time. Really, I need everyone to keep it to 2 minutes. There's a lot of people who want to talk. Ms. Porter, welcome to committee. It's good to see you again and in a different setting. And after this will be Cap O'Rourke. Ms. Porter.
Thank you so much, Chair and committee. Today we're faced with a proposal that could have significant consequences for many individuals in our state. The potential ban on menthol cigarettes in Minnesota is a topic that warrants careful consideration and thoughtful discussion. For many people who smoke menthol cigarettes, this proposed ban represents a direct threat to their freedom of choice and personal autonomy. It is important to recognize that smoking is a complex issue with deep-rooted social and cultural factors at play. Banning menthol cigarettes could disproportionately impact certain communities, especially African Americans, who are close to 90% of menthol users. They have been historically targeted by tobacco companies with menthol products. Furthermore, for individuals who have been smoking menthol cigarettes for years, sudden removal of access to these products could lead to withdrawal symptoms, increased stress, and potentially drive individuals to seek out alternate, potentially more harmful substances and sources of nicotine. It is crucial that we consider the potential unintended consequences of such a ban. Instead of criminalizing individuals who smoke menthol cigarettes, we should focus on providing support and resources to help them make informed decisions about their health and well-being. While the intention behind banning menthol cigarettes may be well taken, we must approach this issue with compassion and understanding for those who would be directly affected. Let us work together to find solutions that promote public health without unfairly targeting specific communities or individuals. And I fail to say, I am the president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Association of Blacks in Criminal Justice. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. All right, we'll move now to Cap O'Rourke, who'll be followed by Tim Gross. Mr. O'Rourke.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Cap O'Rourke. I'm here on behalf of the small vapor industry across the state of Minnesota. The overwhelming data shows that the businesses that are selling primarily vapor products are typically minorities. Overwhelmingly, they are former smokers, and the reason, as Mr. Phelps indicated, that they got into this business is they found a product that, frankly, was working better than all the other previous cessation products that were on the market, which, by the way, a majority of those come in flavors. The reason they come in flavors is that not only do kids prefer flavors, all adults prefer flavors as well in almost every product that they consume. What we have found is that the consumers who are using these to get off of smoking, which is the primary reason for adults using vapor products, they overwhelmingly prefer flavors. And in study after study, the flavors have been indicated as a key reason why they may stick with it, and they stay with their quitting of traditional tobacco products. The reality is, through that, we now have many, many studies. These products, vapor products, are overwhelmingly safer than traditional tobacco products. They are meant for adults. They should not be used by kids. We do need to take make policies that keep them out of the hands of kids, like we did when we passed the age of 21. In the UK right now, these products are being prescribed to adult smokers. We have seen the lowest rate of smoking that we've seen not only in the US, but across in the UK as well, where they're being prescribed. And the youth use of vapor products in both high school and middle school has dropped dramatically from its high point in 2019. The 29 communities that have taken action to restrict flavors, an overwhelming number of those have done so just by limiting to adult stores. They have not followed this legislation and passed a ban, and we fear that if you do pass such a flavor ban, it will have unintended consequences, and it will force those people who have become to rely on their nicotine products to go back to traditional tobacco. Thank you.
Thank you. And next we have Tim Gross, who will be followed by Elliot Boyce. Mr. Gross.
Chair Stevenson and members of the committee, my name is Tim Gross. I'm the executive director of Fueling Minnesota. Our members own and operate the majority of the 2,700 convenience stores, truck stops, and refueling centers found all across Minnesota. We respectfully stand in strong opposition to House File 2177. Per our Retail Coalition letter and submitted Massachusetts Task Force report, it was stated that after a flavor ban, sales decreased in Massachusetts while bordering state tobacco sales increased, meaning a tobacco flavor ban is an ineffective tool to curb tobacco usage. Let me give you a Minnesota True Life example. As a fuel marketer in Duluth, we operated 5 convenience stores within the city limits. We operated 1 store in Superior, Wisconsin. The tobacco category was our third largest category. 32% of our cigarettes and 83% of our smokeless chew and snuff sales were traditional menthol-flavored products. The City of Duluth instituted a tobacco flavor ban that included menthol. After 1 year of the flavor ban, our 5 convenience stores saw a total loss of flavored tobacco sales, but our 1 store in Superior, Wisconsin saw a tremendous increase in sales. In fact, after the first year of Duluth ban, our overall tobacco sales was up 3% versus the prior year. To recap the results of the ban, tobacco sales were not reduced. In fact, overall sales increased in Duluth Superior Metro. 2, Minnesota jobs were lost, along with loss of Minnesota payroll tax revenue shifting to Wisconsin. 3, Minnesota tobacco excise tax and income tax revenues were lost, all shift to Wisconsin. And 4th, most importantly, investments in our Minnesota businesses were slowed. For example, investments in clean fuel transportation options like EV charging, investments in healthier food options, and investments in new locations where food deserts exist. Chair Stevenson and committee members, thank you for your time along to share our concerns.
Thank you. Next, we have Elliot Boyce, who will be followed by Guy Bentley. Mr. Boyce.
My name is Elliot Boyce. I am a retired police officer. I spent 35 years in law enforcement, 20 years in narcotics. Working in narcotics, I will tell you this, I don't smoke and I don't endorse smoking. I do endorse the programs which the ACS, American Cancer Society, has put forth through education, treatment, and counseling that has been successful in reducing smoking, reducing it to the point where young adults are all-time low for smoking. To ban this product or ban products like menthol, which menthol is not the number one consumed product far as when it comes to smoking, is non-menthol products, this is dangerous to the communities, particularly African-American communities. I heard a couple of individuals come up here and talk about statistics, the number of people that are dying and health costs. What they do not tell you is this report comes out from the CDC, and the CDC is these individuals over the age of 68 are the ones that are dying, where the average age of African-American is 67. When you talk about trafficking in the areas where African-Americans consume menthol cigarettes over 85%, that means the enforcement is particularly targeted to those communities, which makes it very dangerous, and in fact, not only with dealing with police officers as far as the trafficking in these communities. Banning menthol cigarettes basically was going to do is create an underground market and under-regulated or not regulated cigarettes. Education and treatment and counseling was the way, not a ban. We keep hearing a lot of things talking about the advertising by Big Tobacco. Did they do it? Yes. But the Master Settlement Agreement, which in 1998 no one talks about or is talking about, basically prevents targeting or advertisement. When they do it, as I hear, there was a successful lawsuit in Minneapolis and Minnesota that raised a lot of funds. These funds should be redirected to cessation programs. But when you talk about targeting one particular community, not a community, another community, gun violence is at an all-time high. If someone thinks banning menthol just because this ban is going to be on the industry, the tobacco companies, the question you all should have is this. What happens after you ban it with those industries? What are your police officers going to do?
I'll need you to conclude your testimony.
I will do. Basically, anything you ban becomes contraband. Anything that's contraband is illegal. Anything that's illegal is a police issue. I assure you, you're going to have police problems because there's going to be no rules or regulations to regulate it. Be careful on this one. It is dangerous. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Guy Bentley, who will be followed by Joe O'Connor. Mr. Bentley.
Chair Stevenson, members of the committee, thank you so much for the opportunity to speak. My name's Guy Bentley. I'm Director of Consumer Freedom at the Reason Foundation, and we're a 501c3 nonprofit think tank. We certainly applaud the attention of the bill to limit and reduce tobacco use, especially amongst youth, but we are concerned that such broad sweeping prohibitions of all, entire product categories can produce unintended consequences. Massachusetts was mentioned, and we did conduct a study on what happened in Massachusetts the year after they banned all flavored tobacco products. And what we saw was a significant increase in the cross-border trade to neighboring states and a decline of $125 million of tax revenue going to Massachusetts, but that being made up for in New Hampshire and Rhode Island and other bordering states. Particularly to the criminal justice implications that were just mentioned by the previous speaker, the Massachusetts Tobacco Illicit Task Force comes out with a report every year and is now saying that there need to be new criminal penalties to clamp down on the increase in the illicit tobacco market because it's grown so large. New storehouses have to be leased to house all the illicit contraband. And there are also mentions of several arrests and more that are being prosecuted this year by that task force. Secondly, as to the other aspect of the bill focused on all flavored tobacco products that aren't combustible, so e-cigarettes, Zyn nicotine pouches, things like this, smokeless tobacco. It should be noted that this bill, as it, in its current form, would ban products that the Food and Drug Administration has authorized as safer than combustible cigarettes and, quote, appropriate for the protection of public health. I'm sure that wasn't the intention when the bill was being written, but right now the bill would ban products that the FDA has authorized because they improve public health, and I'm happy to speak more about that. Also, speaking to the importance of flavors for tobacco harm reduction, switching to safer nicotine alternatives like e-cigarettes, a recent study conducted by researchers at Yale University found that of localities and states that have implemented a flavor ban, for every e-cigarette pod, flavored pod that was not sold as a result of the flavor ban, 13 additional cigarettes were sold instead, which is dramatically more harmful. And that's because e-cigarettes are substitutes, not complements to traditional cigarettes.
And I'll need you to conclude your testimony, sir.
Absolutely. Well, I'll leave it there, and you have my written testimony, and thank you so much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you. Next, we have Joe O'Connor, who will be followed by Jeff Taylor. Mr. O'Connor.
Stevenson, thank you very much, committee members. My name is Joe O'Connor. I'm with Holiday Station Stores / Circle K. I'm in charge of the merchandising and sales and financial results of cigarettes and tobacco. During my time at Holiday, I've seen, we went to the age of 21. Our taxes in the state of Minnesota right now are just about the highest in the nation. If you look at, you've heard Zyn talked about here, Zyn is twice the price right now, a product with no carcinogens in the state of Minnesota. It's twice the price as Minnesota and Wisconsin right now already. Minnesota has done some really good stuff regarding, and I've seen it happen, regarding youth prevention. The cigarette smoking rates are the lowest right now in the U.S. has ever seen, and modified low-risk products that have no carcinogens have grown exponentially in share. I'll admit it's easy to pick on big tobacco, but there's a lot more to the story these days. Other groups will share some very sad stories and emotions will kick in, but there are some really good things happening right now regarding youth prevention and lower smoking rates. Now customers will be pushed back into one of the biggest health crises the U.S. has ever seen, and that's cigarettes. Additionally, how can we not let a farmer running a combine in Farmington or Fairmont buy a grizzly and a mom in Egan buy a bag of THC gummies? That, it just sounds crazy to me. A couple of last things. I don't see a shot clock up here, unfortunately, so I'll hustle
through.
You
have about 30 seconds.
Okay, thank you. Just take a look at what's happening in California right now, you guys. We have stores there, some of our stores at Circle K and another business unit. It's not working. Enforcement is a nightmare. Large percent of retailers simply do not comply right now due to not enough enforcement. The black market has exploded, and employees have lost their jobs like they have in our Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth location. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And Mr. Taylor took his name off the list, so our last testifier is Paul Lampland. Mr. Lampland. Just state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Paul Lampland. I am an advocate for vapors. Thank you, committee and members, for allowing me to give testimony. I'm an employee and contractor as well as a vaping advocate in the industry of tobacco products, and here to testify in opposition of this bill, HF 2177. Working in this industry, I'm opposed to the bill because I believe it is so destructive to the significant number of people employed in retail and distribution of these products, my own livelihood, let alone the business owners and their employees. Banning flavors would significantly eliminate many of the millions of dollars collected in tax and sales tax revenues. This bill would shut down hundreds of businesses in the state, and thousands of employees would lose their jobs. Lots of talk in our politics today about choice. Adults should have the choice to make informed decisions about their own health and which path they choose to quit smoking. This bill assumes that the only flavor of tobacco, only the tobacco flavor, is acceptable. Does the state of Minnesota treat the liquor or cannabis industry this way? Certainly not. Prohibiting flavored tobacco and vaping products does not solve the addiction issue that Member Cha attempts to solve with this bill, any more than liquor prohibition did with alcoholism. Let us be clear, these products are sold legally in the state of Minnesota, are not available to teenagers. They acquire these products in ways that are not regulated by law, and a flavor ban would expand that activity manyfold. I asked the committee with projected deficits in the state budget expected in the coming years, is now really a smart time for pushing flavor ban? I myself was a smoker 25 years ago. I was able to quit my addiction to tobacco.
And I'll need you to conclude your testimony.
And, you know, I certainly don't feel that it's my right to tell others how they should go about that. But addiction is a separate issue than what flavors they use to consume. Thank you.
Thank you. And, sir, you can state your name for the record. Proceed to your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. My name is Tom Bryant. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Wholesale Marketers Association, a wholesale association whose members sell products, including tobacco products, to retailers. Some 5,000 licensed retail stores and wholesalers lawfully sell tobacco products in Minnesota. In Minnesota, 25% of cigarettes sold are menthol. The other 75% are not flavored. 74% of smokeless tobacco sold is flavored, and 72% of cigars sold are flavored. Banning these flavored products will result in significant sales declines and leading to employee hour reductions, layoffs, and possibly business closures. And prohibiting the sale of these products will not reduce the demand for the products. If flavored tobacco is banned, Minnesotans could purchase flavored tobacco products on the state's Native American reservations, cross the border into the four neighboring states, on the internet, or from illicit sellers. An empirical example of the consequences to businesses from a ban on flavored tobacco is Massachusetts, which enacted a flavored ban statewide in June of 2020. In the first 12 months after the ban, cigarette sales in Massachusetts declined by 33 million packs. However, cigarette sales in the neighboring New Hampshire, Rhode Island, and Vermont increased by 30 million packs, almost a 1-to-1 ratio. Moreover, legal sales of flavored tobacco products in Massachusetts were displaced by a widespread illicit market. This 2023 report, which I provided to the committee in an email, by the Massachusetts Illegal Tobacco Task Force, found that cross-border smuggling of untaxed products is the primary challenge for tobacco enforcement and is evidenced by a significant increase in seizures of untaxed products. In short, what has happened in Massachusetts will happen in Minnesota, with legal sales by licensed businesses replaced by cross-border smuggling and illegal sales by illicit sellers. For those reasons, I urge you to not support House File 2177. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We will now move to member discussion and questions. We have a couple members on the list. I do just want members to be aware of the time. We have about 10 minutes before our scheduled time. We can go a little over today. We have three bills left on the agenda, so just be cognizant of that as you're talking. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just kind of worry a little bit because, you know, we've spent so much time trying to regulate an industry that for the past, you know, 50 years, and now we're talking about kind of going back. And so what I'm just kind of curious is, what will is there anything in this bill that will prevent retailers from selling flavorless tobacco right next to, like, the flavor additives? Because I know, weird story, but I had to drop my brother off at the airport this morning to fly back to L.A., and I was asking him about this because I knew this bill was coming up, and he's like, yeah, they just sell the flavors right next to the stuff that's non-flavorful. So he's like, the ban hasn't really had any effect in California. So I'm just kind of curious if that will be part of this and then how it's going to be enforced.
Representative John.
Yes, I'll defer that to the expert, Emily, from the Cancer Society.
Ms. Myatt.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Representative Cagle, so the bill would include flavored tobacco products, but then also the components. We've been paying attention to California and kind of lessons learned from California, and that's why there was the author's amendment today to really broaden out the definitions. And then I can't remember, could you repeat the second question? Sorry.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one of the things that he said is that they can't enforce it there, so yeah. The retailers are still just selling it, and when it started, when they started talking about it, he actually found a retailer that would, like, sell it in the alley because yeah. He was that worried about it.
Ms. Myatt.
Chair Stevenson, Representative Cagle, what we've seen here in Minnesota and the communities that have done this is that enforcement and compliance is going well, and when it's well enforced, right, when localities are working with retailers, doing education. And so what we do in this bill is that licensing, compliance checks, enforcement will continue to happen at the local level, just like it happens now with T21 and other things. And then there's also some enforcement with the Department of Revenue and the Attorney General's Office, and you can see that the AG did send a letter of support of this bill.
Representative Cagle. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just sort of a process question for sure. I think the motion was to send this to health. Is that correct?
No, this has already been heard in health. This is being laid over today.
Oh, it's being laid over. Okay. So my question is then, is this under the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee? This would be coming out of here?
It was a primary referral to the health committee and then referred secondarily to Commerce and is now being laid over here. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is then, do we have a fiscal note on this yet?
Representative Cha, I don't know if you know. I haven't seen a fiscal note. And we're seeing head shakes from staff.
We don't.
All right. Representative Brindley.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't think so. A lot of I had questions, actually, that has been answered, as particularly regarding all of the data that's come out of Massachusetts, California, perhaps. So that was really helpful. I would just say a couple of things because, you know, we've been told for a long time that all this marketing is going to kids. And frankly, the first time I heard that, we have been hearing this bill for years, right? The first time I heard that, I was alarmed. I have my own little built-in focus group, and so I texted all of my teenagers and said, are you seeing advertisements for this? This is crazy. And they all said, yeah, all the time. And I'm like, what? And then they said, telling us how bad it is. So the marketing, I think, at this point, the advertisement really is not towards our youth. In fact, it's the opposite. Kids are being targeted with the message that this is really bad, don't do it. I happen to represent a border community, and interestingly, prior to Sunday sales, we used to watch the cars driving to St. Croix Falls, going to the liquor store in St. Croix Falls, and then coming back. They did nothing else in Wisconsin. We see it right now with fireworks, all the fireworks stands in St. Croix Falls in Wisconsin. Like, we see this all the time. As a border community, I just think this isn't, and it sounds like this is what the data has borne out, that this is not going to decrease use. But, and I asked the question about jurisdiction because it is going to significantly decrease revenue to the state, and it's just going to send that revenue elsewhere. And frankly, you know, I just pulled up the document that was passed in Ways and Means this morning. Not a single area of jurisdiction is going to have a large enough target to absorb the cost of this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Brindley. So we have three members on the list, and then we're going to lay the bill over. I do want, at a minimum, to get to Representative West's bill still today. So please, members, be cognizant of that. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few comments. You know, Representative New Brindley just said the ads aren't targeted towards youth. The youth notice these ads. All you need to do is go to a gas station. You'll see ads on the gas pumps. You'll see them inside the store. You'll see the products themselves with flashy designs. You'll see vapes sold in fruit flavors, candy flavors. I mean, kids notice these. That's why vaping is such a huge issue among youth, and we heard about that. You know, there was some talk in here about, you know, people's freedom of choice and their autonomy, but kind of the flip side of that is the issue of addiction. These are addictive products, and addiction, I would say, is the opposite of being able to make a free choice. There was talk about criminalizing individuals. This bill does not do that. This is a very narrowly drafted bill. If you look to line 3.3 and 3.4 of the bill, it says no licensee, employee, agent of a licensee, out-of-state retailer shall sell or offer for sale any flavored tobacco product to a consumer in this state. This bill is only targeting the retail sale of tobacco products. It does not penalize possession or use or purchase by any young person. So I don't see this as leading to criminalizing individuals. And we talked about kind of the side, we heard some testimony about the side effects of this bill. There was a study that the FDA published that came out a few months ago that showed a quarter of smokers quit within a year of a restriction on the sale of flavored tobacco products. And that's a good thing. I think this is a good bill. Thank you for carrying it, Representative Cha.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Cha, I think it's been very interesting testimony today and what we've heard from what has happened in other states, the concern for the implications for the budget. But I'm also concerned with the bill and the testimony, both verbal and written testimony that we see today, that could create a negative relationship between law enforcement and communities. And I think that's my concern with this bill. I'm seeing that it could result in a greater use of the black market. And frankly, when I look at even the penalties to this, I'm wondering if a lot of our time from our law enforcement entities is going to be spent going after this sort of policy rather than focusing on a broader issue of array of different public safety needs in our communities. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to share some closing comments here. This is a tough issue. We understand that. We have worked on it in the state of Minnesota for a number of years with Tobacco 21, and we thought that was going to take care of it. Keep in mind that the law already says that you, as a person under the age of 21, cannot purchase tobacco and other tobacco-related products that are discussed here today. We've done a number of activities, and guess what? We're back again this year with yet another bill. And is this the one that's going to be the bill of all bills that are going to solve our problems? What I actually think it does is I think it increases the likelihood that we're going to have people acting in an illegal way. Last week we had Representative Hollins here who was talking about the e-waste bill. I raised the question about border states. She was quick to point out that she grew up in Hawaii, which there were no border states there. And I also pointed out the same thing with Alaska. But my point is Minnesota does have competitive border states. And when you take a look at those communities that are on those border states, you're giving people one more reason, lower sales taxes in those other states, with the 3.2% e-waste fee, fireworks. I mean, my goodness, you should just come to my community, the center of the state of Minnesota, and watch the fireworks displays that are on the lakes that are not legal. And so if you're thinking that that's not going to make it to a community near you, oh, boy. We better sit down and have a talk about how life works. Here's the other thing that happens. You give people one more reason to take their business outside of the state of Minnesota. So not only are they going to stop at the Best Buy and buy a television that they don't have to pay taxes on, they're going to purchase fireworks that are illegal, they're going to purchase other tobacco products that aren't available here, they're going to bring them back and they're going to give them to other people. I don't know that this is the bill to end all bills to stop and solve our problem. I think we'll be back next year and the year after. And what will happen is the statute will just continue to grow with laws that we really don't have the ability to be able to enforce because of human nature. And the last thing I want to do is have the Tobacco Police Division created here in the state of Minnesota. They're going to be stopping vehicles coming across the border to look for things like fireworks and tobacco products and TVs and all these kinds of things that were purchased out of state because Minnesota has said we're not going to permit those kinds of things. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And we don't have time for closing comments, so I'm just going to lay the bill over. And then we will move on to the next bill, which is House File 4629 from Representative West. While Representative West is sprinting to the front, I will move House File 4629 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. If you are leaving now, that's totally fine. Just please be quiet as you do so and take your comments, any conversations out in the hallway so we can continue on with our work. Representative West, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right, let's go line by line through the bill and summarize.
The bill is laid over. No, go ahead.
All right, so no summary, but we'll get. This bill repairs some of the damage that was done to the hemp industry in last year's cannabis bill. And you might not know this, but the cannabis bill made a federally illegal product legal in Minnesota. At the same time, it made federally legal products illegal in Minnesota, which simply doesn't make sense, and I don't think it was the intention of the esteemed and wise chair for that to happen. So this bill puts in some more cannabinoids that we know are legal, that we know are safe, and they are non-lethal at literally any dose. And then it also creates a petition process for businesses to petition OCM if they think there's another cannabinoid that should be legal. OCM is then required to have a written reason on why it shouldn't be if they do not intend to improve it. But this, I don't want to summarize the whole bill, but I do want to hit on the last one because it's relevant to the last thing that we just talked about here, and that is vapes. So hemp vapes were made illegal in the cannabis bill, and they are genuinely a safer way to ingest THC as compared to gummies, which were legal in the cannabis bill for hemp-derived products. Vapes have an instant effect, so people know whether they're doing too much or too little, whatever floats their boat, whereas gummies, people don't know. Might be an hour, might be 2 hours before you realize it, and then you're looking down a balcony considering bad choices, which we have seen before in Florida from edibles. So I channeled my inner Ben Johnson to try and craft this bill as reasonable as possible. I would say let's just make it free. Let's let people make their own choices. But I understand people on the left love regulations. People on the right love a little bit of business. And the only thing making these products the only effect of making these products illegal right now is that Minnesota businesses do not profit off them because you can buy all these things online right now today. So without further ado, I will see if we got any testifiers here.
We do have testifiers. We have two. First is Jeff Taylor. Mr. Taylor.
So I'm back again. Jeff Taylor. what I wanted to speak about a little bit is the Department of Health is going out and inspecting, and we have given them a really tough job. I deal with them on a daily basis. Right now, there's a lot of CBD that they're pulling off shelves, and I don't know what everybody knows about CBD. I don't even sell much of it, but I am a manufacturer. Like I said before, you guys are welcome to come down to my facility, and I mean that. But CBD is normally sold to the elderly. There's pain medicine. There's no psychoactiveness. And because of one of the things we always talk about, children, and back to the children, okay? Again, I have children. But a child could eat a whole jar of CBD. They might get sick from the sugar. They will not get sick from the CBD, and they will not get high from the CBD. So I have no clue why we're enforcing CBD. And I'm assuming if you talk to a lot of the people on the Department of Health, they're frustrated with that also because you have them out there doing things that they could be doing more important things in enforcement. In regards to vaping, back to the vaping deal, if again, I don't know what everybody knows about THC, but if you take a vape and you vape a vape, first of all, you can lock it off where children don't even do it, number one, okay? All of them are almost lockouts. They'd have to know how to do it. Then they'd have to know how to use it. And even if they knew how to use it and hit it once or twice, they know where they're at in 3 minutes, 2 minutes. Okay, well, if you take a gummy and it don't work, you know, if you've ever done this, you know, took a gummy 45, half hour later, it doesn't work. Your buddy says, ah, take another one. Take another one. You know, and then all of a sudden there are five gummies into it. Well, that's not as fun. A vape lasts about 45 minutes to an hour, and it's gone. A gummy lasts 5 hours, 6, 7, 8, 10 hours for some people. And so why you can do a gummy, which has sugars and other things, if we could talk about the health part of it, and not use a vape, I guess it's their choice, and that's how I feel about that. That's all I have to say about it. You guys have a great day.
Thank you. Last, we have Ava Droz. If you could just come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Yes. Mr. Chair, thank you for having me here today. My name is Eva Droz. I'm a co-owner of Nothing But Hemp. I'm here to support the bill, HF 4629. Thank you, Representative West and Representative Jessica Hansen, for all your hard work on this bill. We started out as a two-person BIPOC women-owned company with a kiosk in Maplewood Mall, and have grown to multiple locations and over 60 employees. We have been serving and educating Minnesotans about cannabis for the past 5 years. We've grown with the industry here. We get to hear the testimonials every day from our customers about how hemp-derived cannabinoids have improved their life naturally and without side effects. We want to still be able to offer our customers non-psychoactive cannabinoids such as CBC and CBN. These are naturally occurring, not converted by chemicals. HF 4629 will allow us to continue to be able to offer these safe cannabinoids. Our customers love being able to buy these locally and not have to order from online or out of state. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We'll now move to member discussion and questions. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, on the West bill, my preference would have been that Representative West just would have brought us jelly-filled donuts, different varieties and kinds, instead of trying to suck up to the chair on how great this bill was last year. We could all have benefited from that.
I like Representative West's approach. Representative West, closing comments.
This is a bipartisan bill, and it'd be great to be enacted, and thanks for hearing it.
All right. And with that, the bill is laid over. We'll next turn to House File 4029 from Representative Tabke. While Representative Tabke makes his way up to conserve time, I will move House File 4029 be laid over. He also has an author's amendment, which is the A24. I'll move the A24, and now he's there, so I'll let him describe the A24.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. The A24 gets the bill, it gets the language the way we need for proper inclusion.
All right. Any discussion to the A24? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. 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 Opposed? Motion prevails. A24 is adopted. Representative Tabke, to your bill is amended.
Thank you very much, Chair Stevenson and members. So this is the five-hour rule, and so it was included in the cannabis bill, the marijuana bill last year. And so what it means is that there's a five-hour, anytime within 5 hours of someone ingests THC or edibles, they cannot be served alcohol, and it is untenable to enforce and use. It puts bartenders and bar owners at disadvantage and liability. And so what we're doing here is putting this on par with dram shop laws and making sure that they are no one is able to be served when they are intoxicated. And so this is supported by Hospitality Minnesota, Minnesota Craft Brewers, MLBA, MMBA, and they are here to testify if we'd like, but we can forego that for questions.
I think we can have Mr. Galligan come down and testify if he wants. He signed up to testify. So, Mr. Galligan, if you want to just state your name for the record, proceed your testimony.
2 minutes, Mr. Chair?
2 minutes.
Okay, I'll speak on it. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bob Galligan. I'm the Director of Government Industry Relations for the Minnesota Craft Brewers Guild, and I'm here to voice our strong support for House File 4029. With the passage of House File 100 last year, Minnesota became a national leader in a new and exciting market of low-dose hemp-derived THC beverages. Although it is not current law, come March of 2025, when Statute 15172 is repealed, language states that bartenders across the state would not be able to serve THC beverages to somebody who has consumed alcohol within the past 5 hours. Although we fully respect the intent of that language, as a former bartender, I can safely say that the enforcement of that rule would simply be impossible. There is no feasible way for us to know what our patrons have consumed before they enter our establishments, and the only way of knowing their consumption is to look for signs that we are already trained to look for, the signs of intoxication. Although we acknowledge the possibility of enhanced intoxication by consuming alcohol and THC concurrently, the signs of intoxication are generally the same, although we support more research in this area. We also firmly believe that by instilling the five-hour language, that would force patrons that we know are already combining these substances to consume one or the other before entering our establishments, as opposed to allowing bartenders to monitor consumption throughout that patron's visit. By inserting the language of House File 4029, it ultimately allows for greater freedom for the citizens of Minnesota. It further helps decrease the stigma that those who consume THC have dealt with for decades, and it ultimately allows bartenders the ability to do their job and control the environment in their spaces. This language has been worked on and agreed to by stakeholders, such as the Craft Brewers Guild, Hospitality Minnesota, the Minnesota Licensed Beverage Association, the Municipal Beverage Association, which you'll see our coalition letter, which is the first of its kind, probably ever. We are very thankful and grateful for Representative Tapke's hard work on this bill. So as the trade organizations, the bartenders, and the beer tenders of this state, we strongly ask for your support on House File 4029 and allow Minnesota to continue leading the nation and, frankly, the world. Having said that, thank you for your time. If you have any questions, let me know.
All right. We'll move to member discussion and questions. And I just want to note for people who are watching we are going a little fast here. This bill, the next bill, and the last bill are largely included in the omnibus bill, which is going to get a hearing in on Wednesday, where there's more opportunity for discussion and questions. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Tapke, you hit on this mostly. I mean, this is bringing it in alignment with other laws. My question is there a reason that we couldn't do an or rather than eliminating the initial language? I mean, it seems like if a retailer does know that they've consumed alcohol within the previous 5 hours or is intoxicated, they may know that without someone being obviously intoxicated. So it seems like it would be logical to make that an or rather than eliminating the previous language for the new language.
Representative Tapke.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative New Brindley. Yeah, I appreciate what you're saying there. And what we had talked about that as to where we should go with that. But the fact is we want to make sure that training and all of the work that's done to make sure that this is able, that bartenders and folks who are in the service industry are able to identify and know and have a streamline, that it's a consistent piece moving forward. And so we wanted to make sure that it's consistent with intoxication from alcohol at the same time. And so making sure that all that is trained at the same time and moving forward in the same way and not have multiple paths for it.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. And I would just say again, you know, we're trying to move forward in the same way. However, this is a different issue. We are introducing a different substance here, which is why it might make sense to treat it just a little bit differently. And while I certainly agree with the language for use of an obviously intoxicated person, it seems also reasonable to say, well, if a retailer knows that they've been served alcohol within 5 hours, then we could also still use, that's an even easier metric. If the retailer knows that, I would either way remove the language reasonably should know, because that becomes very subjective and puts the retailer at far more risk. That does not make sense. But if they do know, then I don't know why we wouldn't hold them accountable for that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You have 10 seconds of closing comments.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
All right. And with that, the bill is laid over. Our last bill on the agenda today is House File 4377, which is my bill. Given the lateness of the hour, I'm just going to do this from up here. So I will move House File 4377. Be laid over. Members, this is a bill related to packaging products being used inappropriately in violation of copyright laws. I have examples here that I'll pass around that some of our corporate citizens in the area have become alerted to. We actually looked at this last year but couldn't figure out the enforcement mechanism in a timely enough fashion to get it into House File 100. But essentially, some bad actors, largely overseas, are manufacturing counterfeit material that is copyrighted, that's designed to be, as you will see, very appealing to kids. It should not be allowed. This is changing the enforcement to ensure that we have the tools to go after, to ensure these aren't sold in Minnesota. There was no one who signed up to testify, so we'll just go to member discussion and questions to the bill. And seeing no discussion or questions, we'll lay the bill over. That concludes today's agenda. See you on Wednesday. The meeting is adjourned.